People have always said that of her four children, I am the closest to her in appearance. I could only hope that she might have a few good months left. We had an inconclusive discussion as to what she should do with what time she still had. My mother was one of the bravest and most philosophical people I know, but neither of us could bring ourselves to refer to death by name. I was on call for the weekend and was telephoned endlessly by a new and inexperienced registrar about many difficult problems. These were not clinically difficult problems, but problems caused by the chronic lack of beds. On the following Monday, there were various complaints from patients about my trying to discharge them from hospital too quickly. One of the complaining patients was a garrulous old man who was reluctant to go home with an indwelling urinary catheter after a simple spinal operation. I told him that he would be doing another patient a favour if he went home that day, since we had no beds available for the patients who were due to be admitted for surgery next day. He was still on the ward 3 days later, and the ward sister criticised me for having spoken to him in the way that I had, although I thought that I had been scrupulously polite. I had had to cancel an operation on a woman with severe trigeminal neuralgia because he wouldn't leave. The ward sister, nevertheless, told me that I had to apologise to him for having tried to get him to leave the hospital before he wished. So I went to say sorry to him through silently gritted teeth. He accepted this happily. "Yes, I understand, doctor," he said. "I used to work in the kitchen fitting trade and sometimes couldn't complete a job on time. I also dislike disappointing people." I muttered something about brain surgery and building kitchen cupboards not being entirely equivalent and left his room. A balcony room, overlooking the hospital gardens and trees, with a distant view towards Epsom on the horizon. I was still working in the old hospital at the time. It was to be closed 3 years later. Perhaps if he had been in a more typical NHS bay and not in a room on his own with a view of the hospital gardens and the many daffodils I had planted years before, he might have wanted to leave earlier. I was away in Glasgow at a medical meeting 2 days later when the diagnosis of untreatable cancer was finally made and my mother was sent home to die. There was no question of chemotherapy in somebody her age with such advanced disease, and she didn't want it either, which my father found hard to accept. I returned from Glasgow and went to my parents' house to find them sitting in the kitchen. My mother had become more jaundiced from liver failure since I had last seen her, and looked worn and frail, though fully herself.
I don't want to leave you all," she said sadly, "but I don't think death is the end, you know."
My 86-year-old father, already starting to suffer from the dementia from which he died 8 years later, looked on with a vague, lost expression as though he couldn't really take in what was happening. That his 50-year-old son was crying over his wife of over 60 years and that she was shortly to die. Her condition deteriorated very quickly over the next few days, and she was dead within a fortnight. A short illness, as the obituaries call it, though it felt quite long while it lasted. Until the very end, she remained entirely lucid and completely herself, with her slightly ironical, modest sense of humour preserved until the last. Each day she weakened, and soon she was established in a bed during the day in the music room downstairs. I would carry her up the staircase of my parents' house in my arms at the end of the day. By now she weighed next to nothing. But even this was quickly too much for her, and so after discussion with myself and one of my sisters, who is a nurse, my mother remained in the bedroom she had shared with our father for the last 40 years. This, she decided, would be where she would die. It was a beautiful room, a perfectly proportioned Georgian room with wood panelling, painted a quiet, faded green, and an open fireplace and mantelpiece decorated with her collection of little pottery birds and eggs. The tall windows, with their rectangular panes of glass, looked out over the trees of Clapham Common, especially beautiful at that time of year. To the left, one could see the church on the common, which she attended every Sunday, and where her funeral service would be held. Every morning and evening, my sister and I would come in to care for her. At first, I would help her to the bathroom, where my sister would wash her, but soon she was unable to walk even this short distance, and instead I would lift her onto the commode we had borrowed from the local hospice. My sister was wonderful to watch, kindly and gently discussing and explaining everything as she carried out the simple, necessary nursing. We have both seen many people die, after all, and I had worked as a geriatric nurse many years ago, too. It felt quite easy and natural for us both, I think, despite our intense emotions. It's not that we felt anxious. The three of us knew she was dying. I suppose what we felt was simply intense love, a love quite without ulterior motive, quite without the vanity and self-interest of which love is so often the expression. "It's a quite extraordinary feeling to be surrounded by so much love," she said 2 days before she died. "I count my blessings." She was right to do this, of course. I doubt if any of us will enjoy, if that's the word to use, such a perfect death when our own time comes. To die in her own home, after a long life, quite quickly, looked after by her own children, surrounded by her family, entirely free of pain. A few days before she died, almost by chance, the family, children, grandchildren, and even great-grandchildren, and two of her oldest friends, found themselves all gathered in the family home. We staged what amounted to an impromptu wake before her death, much to my mother's delight. While she lay dying upstairs, we sat down round the dining-room table and remembered her life, and drank to her memory, even though she was not yet dead, and ate supper cooked by my wife-to-be, Kate. I had only met Kate, to my mother's joy, after the trauma of the end of my first marriage a few months earlier. Kate had been slightly surprised to find herself cooking supper for 17 people when earlier in the day I had hesitantly asked her if she might cook supper for 5. Each day I thought might be the last, but each morning when I returned she would say to me, "I'm still here." Once, when I told her, as I kissed her good night, that I would see her in the morning, she replied with a smile, "Dead or alive?" My family were playing out an age-old scene that I suppose is rarely seen now in the modern world, where we die in impersonal hospitals or hospices, cared for by caring professionals, whose caring expressions, just like mine at work, will disappear off their faces as soon as they turn away, like the smiles of hotel receptionists. Dying is rarely easy, whatever we might wish to think. Our bodies will not let us off the hook of life without a struggle. You don't just speak a few meaningful last words to your tearful family and then breathe your last. If you don't die violently, choking or coughing or in a coma, you must gradually be worn away, the flesh shriveling off your bones, your skin and eyes turning deep yellow if your liver is failing, your voice weakening, until, near the end, you haven't even the strength to open your eyes, and you lie motionless on your deathbed, the only movement your gasping breath. Gradually you become unrecognizable. At least you lose all the details that made your face characteristically your own, and the contours of your face are worn away down to the anonymous outlines of your underlying skull. You now look like the many old people with drawn and dehydrated faces, identical in their hospital gowns, to whose bedside I would be summoned in the early hours when I worked as a junior doctor down the long and empty hospital corridors to certify death. Your face.